Rural health policy will come to order. We have a couple of interesting bills this morning. We'll start with, we'll open a public hearing, possible work session, maybe not, public hearing on Senate Bill 164. Yes, would you please come up? Diana Helwig. Would you introduce yourself, please?
Good morning. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I'm Deanna Hartwig. I'm the administrator of the Office of Federal Resource and Financial Eligibility, Senior and People with Disabilities Division, Department of Human Services. And I'm here to talk to you today about Senate Bill 164. This bill relates to reporting requirements for public assistance. The Deficit Reduction Act of 2005 changed the federal law regarding the asset transfer look-back period for certain aged, physically disabled, and developmentally disabled individuals applying for Medicaid from 3 years to 5 years. The asset look-back is a federal requirement to assure that individuals don't transfer their assets solely for the purpose of becoming eligible for Medicaid. The Act, however, did not change the look-back time period for other client groups, so now the Department has differing look-back periods for individuals, only one of which is 5 years. So this bill would remove Section 1BC relating to asset transfers, as there are existing federal and state regulations to guide the Department when evaluating individual situations.
Okay.
So that, in essence, is...
Questions? Yeah, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really glad that this has come forward. And I only have information anecdotally, but it's with the baby boomers proliferating, it seems, into the age of the elderly. I just anecdotally know so many families that say, "Oh, I don't want to have to pay for assisted living or that for my," and they have started transferring all of their parents' assets over to the children just solely because they want the state to pay everything. And so I'm glad to see this happening.
Other questions? Okay, so you are looking, now go over that again. You're looking at other guidelines that you, existing guidelines that you have.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, that is correct. There are specific federal requirements for each client group who applies for Medicaid.
I see.
So for the aged, physically disabled, and developmentally disabled, the asset look-back time period is 5 years.
Okay.
For children, adults, and families who operate Medicaid programs, I think they have some three-year asset look-back time periods.
Okay.
So having a time period specific in the statute, it would either need to address each particular group and
okay.
the look-back time period, or just say follow the existing
okay.
state and federal regulations that guide the groups that you're determining
okay.
eligibility for.
Good. That's what I thought. But that's a good, another clarification.
Yes. Yeah.
Other questions?
No, Mr. Chair, it just makes sense because you never know what the feds are going to do, and to be able to
yeah,
address it and
right.
rule
yeah.
is a much more,
right.
expeditious way to do it.
Okay, thank you very,
thank you.
Very much, Diana. Others wishing to testify on Senate Bill 164? Okay, seeing no others, we will close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 164.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 164 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senate Bill 164 is moved to the floor of the Senate by Senator Cruz with a due pass recommendation. Comments? Concerns? Will the clerk call the roll, please?
Senator Walsh Anderson.
Yes.
Senator Berger.
Yes.
Senator Telfer.
Telfer, and it's yes.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Morrison.
Aye. Okay. Bill passes at the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Cruz, would you
Mr.
like to
Chair, I was going to suggest that we let the newbie carry the first
the
bill
newbie.
Out of
yeah.
this. this committee.
I would be happy to do that.
Good. And you can give your CPA analysis of the fiscal and all the money that the state is.
We have both revenue and fiscal, Mr.
Yeah, we're good to go on this.
So. But you can talk
but
about how the state is going to save money on this.
I don't want to put
in my file.
Okay. Very good. Moving right along. Okay, we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 173. Would you like to give an update on Senate Bill 173?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 173 increases the number of members to the State Board of Psychological Examiners from 7 to 9 members. And we have both a revenue and fiscal impact statement, and there's none of either.
Okay. Okay, we have, no one has signed up to testify, so I will close the public hearing and open a work session. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, let me make the motion first. I move Senate Bill 173 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves 173 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Telfer.
My question is, why are we increasing it from 5 to 6? Didn't know what the real driving force behind this was.
Yes, Senator.
Chair, I would agree. I hate passing a bill without getting a little bit of, and it looks like maybe someone's here to talk about it.
Someone is here.
Okay.
Can I jump in? Oh, absolutely. Yes, please come forward.
173?
Yeah.
Yes, you were probably not here in time to sign up for the testimony.
Yes, I misunderstood.
Oh, okay. Okay, good. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Chair Morissette, should I start?
Yes.
Okay.
Identify yourself, please.
Yes. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Deborah Orman-McHugh, and this is our chair, Susan Latham. She's a public member of the board.
Okay.
I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Board of Psychologist Examiners.
Okay.
I'm here with Ms. Latham to support this bill. The mission of our board is to protect consumers of psychological services in the state of Oregon against the unethical, unprofessional, unlicensed practice of psychology. We're the agency that screens, tests, licenses, and disciplines psychologists. In addition, we investigate and level civil penalties against individuals who practice psychology without a license. Currently, the board has 7 members, 5 PhD psychologist professional members, and 2 public members. The bill before you today proposes adding 2 additional board members, 1 public member and 1 additional psychologist member, and making master's degree licensees eligible for board membership. There are several reasons why the board wants to expand the size and the eligibility of board membership. At least 50% of board meetings are spent discussing, reviewing, and voting on disciplinary cases. At some board meetings, we may have a vacant position or a legitimate absence. In effect, that leaves us with 5, and in some cases, only 4 board members to review and vote on cases at that particular meeting. In addition, when a board member has a prior relationship with the licensee under investigation, the board member often removes themselves from the discussion and the decision-making, recuse themselves. Again, that leaves us with 4 or 5 members to make a very important decision. The board feels this is an inadequate number, particularly when one of the absent board members may be the only expert on that particular topic on the board. Finally, the board believes this bill is a creative way to save board budget resources. Adding 2 board members, it's estimated, would cost the board approximately $2,000 for the biennium for travel. Our per diem is pretty low, so about $2,000. First, we'd be utilizing volunteer board members, and we would improve our ability to investigate and decide disciplinary cases in a more timely fashion. That is, we wouldn't have to contract out for services of an expert because we would have them on the board, which we currently do if we can. So we would decide the cases in a more timely fashion without adding additional investigatory staff positions. Secondly, an increase in board members would improve our diversity of training, experience, and background on the board. This resource will reduce the need for costly outside experts, as I said, typically costing $2,500 to $5,000, depending on how long they're involved, the expert in the case, and whether it goes to hearing and such. Current, and then the second piece of this, so that has to do with adding two board members, and then the second piece has to do with adding or allowing their second category of licensee to be eligible to sit on the board. The way the law was written initially was that only a PhD psychologist could sit on the board and be eligible to sit on the board, but we have a second category called a psychologist associate, and they are master's levels licensees. We only have two categories. And they're not eligible to sit on the board. So basically this would allow them, this bill also, to sit on the board, not as a set-aside, but just they would be eligible so they could apply to sit on the board as well. And for us it's an equity issue. And in addition, they bring a different kind of expertise based on their work and the kind of work that they do, which can sometimes be a little different than a psychologist. And that's pretty much it. It's a pretty simple thing. So thank you for your time and the opportunity to testify, and I can answer questions.
Would you like to testify?
I would just like to add, Senator Morissette, and thank you for allowing me to speak, members of the committee, because I am a
Identify.
I'm Susan Latham, and I'm the chair of the board, and I am by profession a social worker.
Okay.
Particularly being a public member, I really wish that you would consider this bill, because I think adding a public member really adds to the committee, along with adding another professional member. But oftentimes, being a public member with only two, I have been the only public member, because we have been in transition to get another public member on the committee. We've been waiting for the confirmation. If I have to recuse myself, which I often do because my previous background was in a training facility of many of the PhDs who unfortunately sometimes come before the board, that leaves no public member. With an addition of another public member, that would probably secure that at all times there would be a public member in the room discussing disciplinary actions. I think the public member's view is a little different than the professional member, and they really do add to decision making and how you think about things that come before the board. So I would ask you to really consider this. Thank you very much.
What's the criteria for choosing a public member? What are the qualifications, if any, for
Interest.
You're in a related field.
I am in a related field.
So, and you're a public member.
Yes, I am.
So.
Oh, retired.
I am retired.
Okay. But do you select people who understand what the board is all about?
Not necessarily. not necessarily. We've had a couple of attorney members that were real helpful to be on the board, just given their background and understanding kind of... So they're chosen. They apply to the governor's office. A lot of times a citizen will apply and say, I'm interested in sitting on a board. This is my topic of interest. Sometimes we have from NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. That's a very large association, and they will submit names of folks who would be good public members that they think would bring something to the table.
Thank you. Senator Montes-Angerson.
Just to follow up on that line, you don't require to have consumers.
Senator Morissette, Senator Montes-Angerson, no, we don't.
Mm-hmm.
Have you thought of that?
Well, as it turns out, sometimes folks are both.
A consumer as a member of the board gives a special kind of understanding of what is going on. But
Senator Morissette, I think sometimes that is what the public member is supposed to be representing, but doesn't always. You're absolutely right, because maybe they're not a consumer, but they are that voice. But it's certainly a good idea.
Yes.
And then I had another question when you said, I'm not quite sure, when you were talking about the outside expert opinions and how this would change that. Wouldn't you still want to have expert opinions on a case that was a little complicated?
Chair Morissette, Senator Montes-Anderson, it depends. Sometimes it's so far afield For example, maybe we had a case recently that somebody was thought to be prescribing medication, and we didn't have anybody on the board at that time that had any experience with that, who would know whether that was a poor outcome, poor idea, or anything, so we had to contract out. We now currently have somebody on the board who could eyeball that and just say, this really was not a problem. That's a standard of care. People who have a certain kind of training, not prescribing, but that was the question, is this prescribing? And now we have somebody on the board who's an expert, has been trained on prescribing medications, all that's not allowed in the state at this time. Did that answer your question?
Well, so your intent with this bill would to be bring someone on that maybe had expertise, so you wouldn't need to bring someone else in, that you would, it says sometimes this resource will reduce the need for costly outside expert opinions costing $25 to $5,000 each. So with your intent, you're wanting to look to bring someone on board that has the expertise in what field? I mean,
it would be analogous to where the medical board has a podiatrist on the board. They have different specialties represented, and while we're not looking for set-asides, it would be another thing that we would be looking for. For example, someone that does parenting and custody evaluations. It's a thing we get a lot of cases on, and we often have to pay an expert to review them because we don't have that expertise on the board. It's a specialty within psychology. Some people do exclusively that. So what we're thinking is that the more people we have on, the breadth of backgrounds we would have to choose from and the breadth of expertise we would have.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that you wouldn't still have to bring in expert
That's
help.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Do you have a DOJ that attends your board meeting?
Yes.
And
AG Warren Foote.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. And they guide you?
Very well.
For instance, not to write prescriptions, right?
Yeah. Excuse me?
Concerning prescriptions.
Oh.
Yeah, I understand, and that's the purpose of having the DOJ, is to give guidance in terms of the existing statutes and so on and so forth.
Chair Morissette, the AAG gives us guidance as to the law,
mm-hmm.
and standards of practice and such mm-hmm. come from the professional board members.
Right, I understand that. Yeah, thank you.
And one other question.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Are the board members now voluntary?
Chair Morissette, Senator Montes Anderson, yes, they receive a per diem and travel, but yes, they're volunteer.
So they get per diem for meals, is what you're saying, and
mileage,
overnight.
That sort of thing.
They get a per diem of $30 for their time.
How about overnight lodging?
No,
they get travel and lodging, and we feed them.
Okay.
Yes.
So will this mean you're looking to increase fees for members of the association or the...
Chair Morissette, yeah. Senator Montes Anderson, I actually have a fee
bill
related
bill.
To my budget, but it has nothing to do with this. It's
yeah.
We haven't raised fees in 10 years, so...
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, the no revenue impact, minimum fiscal impact, as opposed to no fiscal impact...
The minimum is, I mean, that is a statement, so that qualifies for moving the bill. So, Ms. Chair, we are in work session, and I don't have a question.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
But, and we do have a motion on the floor, but I guess I would just opine for a minute. In most cases, I'm hard-pressed to want to increase the size of a board. But this still falls within my personal scope of a functional board at 9. It's still functional. And, you know, you get too big and you run into problems, and this still fits under that matrix for me. I like the idea of adding another public member. I mean, these are, we approve these appointments, and the governor makes them, and so I would think with three public members, the opportunity the governor would have to make sure an advocate filled one of the, or a consumer filled one of those positions would be greater. And for the board's perspective, wanting to be able to expand the scope of expertise on the board, I think makes some sense. And I'm also very happy with allowing somebody with a master's degree the opportunity to sit on the board, because it is a slightly different field of practice. And so at this point, those folks aren't necessarily represented on the board. So I think that's a good add too. So when I looked at this, I thought it made sense. So
good. Senator Bridger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess that I'm always prone to rather go up in requirements of people serving rather than going down. I think you want as much expertise as possible on a board. I like the public members, so my question to you is, tell me a little bit about the requirements if you go to this psychologist associates. Tell me who those people are, what credentials they would have, and why you feel that they would offer something different to the board.
Chair Morissette, Senator Verger, they are psychologist associates. They have a master's degree, and then they're required to be under supervision of a psychologist for an additional 5 years. They do the same work as a psychologist. That category was created years ago when there was no board of counseling, and it was a way for master's degree folks to become employed and do the work. And they do exactly the same work as a psychologist. The difference is, again, they have the master's and then they're under supervision, which means everything is looked at in their practice for 5 years, and then they can apply to be an independent psychologist associate. They are one of our two categories of licensees, and their practices look very much like a psychologist's practice, but they see it is a little bit different in who they, maybe their clients would be. Can you speak to that, Susan?
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yes, I think that's what I'm trying to get at. What is the purpose in adding someone that perhaps has less credentials in this situation unless they offer something different than the people on the board? I'm much more inclined to want to keep the most professional people you have when they're making decisions that are very important. So I'm trying to figure out why you want that, because you also have citizen members of the board, which I can understand the expansion of that, giving a nice balance, but I'm not sure I understand exactly where you're going.
Okay, Chair Morissette, Senator Verger, I believe that the psychologist associates would tell you that they work with probably a different group of clientele. They're more likely to do sliding fee scale kinds of treatment. They usually, they're paid less because they have a lesser degree, so they do get a different group of folks than a PhD psychologist. A lot of folks can't afford that, especially if they're uninsured, or particularly if they're uninsured. They can get the same services. They can get a psychological evaluation, for example, for less money.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Is this the analogy, or maybe equivalent to a physician assistant, or do they practice on their own?
Chair Morissette, they
do. In a different location?
They do.
And are they in rural settings sometimes?
Southern Oregon, yes.
Okay. And they work under the direction of a PhD?
Chair
Are they attached to a particular person as their mentor or as their supervisor?
Yes, we have them under contract. It's like a three-way contract between the psychological associate, the psychologist, and the board. So we monitor that for 5 years.
Okay, so their presence on the board would be, in a sense, to speak for that category and to kind of make sure that they're not overlooked or misunderstood and so on. I mean, they're there to... Sure. Yeah, okay. So I see them kind of as a physician assistant, that we are increasing in many ways not only the scope of practice, but also the independence. And they are asking for a seat on their board. The physician assistants want to be on the board of examiners.
I think you could draw that analogy.
Yeah, because there are issues that come up that affect them, and they have no voice. So, Senator Cruz?
Yeah, that, you know, Mr. Chair, quite simply, it's taxation without representation. And I mean, they have two classes of license that they oversee, and it makes sense that both classes would be eligible to serve on the board that regulates them. You know, it's not a level of expertise. It's to make sure that there's a voice there,
yeah.
I think. So,
yeah, that sounds okay. Other questions, comments? We are in the work session. We have a motion.
Mm-hmm.
Discussion of the motion. Further discussion. Would the clerk call the roll, please? Thank you.
Yes. Yes.
Telfer.
Yes.
It's a tough one.
It's an LF. I know it rolls off the tongue better with that reversed.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. And Senator Cruz will carry this bill.
I think I just did. So.
Yes, you did. You did. You carried it. Yes, absolutely. Okay, we will open a, let's see, where are we? 173? 174. Okay, we're open a public hearing on Senate Bill 174. Okay, 174 increases from $1,000 to $10,000, a maximum civil penalty amount the State Board of Psychological Examiners may impose for disciplinary violations. You're back. Okay, would you take your seat, please, and introduce yourself, and we'll start over. I should say we will continue. Now that you have a larger board... You'd be much better off.
Chair Morris, that
so, yeah, you're going to zap these people 10 times more than you did before, right?
No, sir.
Okay.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, again, my name is Deborah Orman-McHugh, Executive Director of the Board of Psychologist Examiners. This bill, Senate Bill number 174, before you is aimed at individuals who practice psychology without a license and are a danger to the public. These individuals often have no appropriate training or education in psychology or any other mental health field. A civil penalty is this board's only recourse to stop someone who violates the board's practice act. Currently, this board is statutorily authorized to level a civil penalty up to $1,000. For those practicing without a license, $1,000 is not a deterrent to stop. Given the potential of income that they can generate, $1,000 is just not a deterrent. Moreover, many simply refuse to pay it. When an individual refuses to pay the penalty of $1,000, it costs an equal amount in staff time and collection fees to try to collect that $1,000. Senate Bill 174 would authorize the board to level a civil penalty of up to $10,000 and provides an operational chilling effect on individuals who threaten the safety of the public by practicing illegally and without a license. Finally, and very importantly, a larger civil penalty will help defray the investigative and administrative hearing costs incurred pursuing unlicensed practice cases that are currently being supported and paid for by law-abiding licensees. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I look forward to answering any questions you might have.
Would you like to speak?
Senator Morissette, thank you very much for allowing me to speak. My name is Susan Latham, and I'm the chairman of the Oregon Board of Psychology Examiners. In terms of the public protection, I think this bill is vital in helping to understand that just because someone says that they do therapy, they may not have the professional skills to adequately treat you. We are trying to induce these people to stop practicing in this way. I think when the general public is in need for psychological services and they're hurting for either themselves, their families, their children, they will go to whoever has an appointment, and they don't necessarily know that they don't have the professional credentials to treat them properly and can do serious, serious harm. We would like to have a way to be able to stop this from happening so that the public is protected, and $1,000 has not achieved that. So we would like to have the ability to increase our fines. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Moniz Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give me an idea of what kind of complaints have come to your board that makes you feel that this is necessary? How do you know how many or if there are people who are practicing without a license? How do you find that out?
Chair Morissette, Senator Moniz Anderson, we find out the public will call. A psychologist will call, other professionals who have seen somebody after they've gone to an unlicensed practitioner. Often the person that's been harmed, we have, a recent case that we have has to do with false credentials. The person said they had a PhD, et cetera, and did not. That's one case we're pursuing. Cases, they're similar to the ones we might see with a psychologist, such as a breach of confidentiality and such. And when they complain to us, we find out that they're not licensed. They also advertise on the internet quite a bit. They'll offer to treat serious mental illnesses such as schizophrenia, chronic major depression, et cetera, with no experience or training whatsoever. And those folks, we initially write them a letter to cease and desist, offering to treat serious mental illnesses when they're not qualified to do so. And if they refuse to do that, we sort of go up the ladder, and fining is one of the ways that we can stop them.
Follow up?
Yes.
But do you have numbers? I mean, how many complaints do you get to your board per year? Do you have those?
Chair Morissette, Senator Moniz Anderson, we had very few in the past, and this last year the board instructed me to, if we come across somebody, to be more proactive in pursuing that and bringing, opening a complaint and bringing it to the board. And this past year we had 25.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Senator Bridger.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to make a comment. $1,000 is really not much of a deterrent to someone. The protection of people's mental health, I feel, is extremely important to be in the hands of people that are not trained and do not have maybe the best practices. I'm very supportive of the idea, regardless of how many cases they've had in the past. Mm-hmm. I think we need to protect the public in the future, and not have people that have not gone through all the hoops, gone through all the education, paid the kind of money that an education costs today, besides having the skills to deal with people's mental problems. And I think this is very serious, and I think it's, regardless of how many cases they get, I really feel it's a preventive thing in the future to have people not having credentials and treating people and certainly making a fairly good living doing so. So I would encourage the committee to really take seriously this bill.
Okay. Thank you. Other comments?
Just, if you remember, Mr. Chair, last session there were several boards came to us and asked for us to increase their fine limit. And it was appropriate for them. It's appropriate in this case as well.
Okay, thank you very much. We will close the public hearing and open the work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 174 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, thank you. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 174 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Would you call the roll, please? Further discussion? No further discussion. Call the roll, please.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. Senator Cruz, you want to carry this one as a companion to the last bill?
If that's your pleasure, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to do it.
Well, you've got, as long as you've got the previous one, okay, Senator Cruz will carry.
This could be one of those good bill should pass four speeches, I think.
Yeah. So. Okay, we are going to skip over. Uh, 162, we're going to come back to, and we're going to go to 177. So we've opened a public hearing on Senate Bill 177. Okay, Becky Rasmussen. Martin Kiffin. Okay. Would you introduce yourself, please, and you can start your testimony.
Sure. Chair Morissette and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Becky Rasmussen, and I'm a licensed clinical social worker with a private practice in Salem. I currently serve as vice chair of the Board of Clinical Social Workers and appear before you today together with our executive director, Martin Pidioni, in support of the board's Senate Bill 177. My focus here will be to briefly explain the regulatory environment of the board, which I think will help the committee understand why we asked for this bill and what the impact of it would be. Our executive director will then briefly review the technical amendments we would respectfully ask the committee to request from legislative counsel, and then both of us would be happy to answer any questions. Oregon is one of only seven states in the nation that does not protect the practice of the social work profession, including the clinical social work profession. This means that anyone who wants to practice any form of social work at any level, including clinical social work, which involves assessment, diagnosis, and therapy services, can practice without licensure or penalties from this board for not having a license. Social workers can be found but are not limited to hospitals, schools, medical clinics, mental health clinics, and in private practice, as well as in community settings in both urban and rural areas. The board's authority is strictly limited to those who choose to voluntarily become licensed, either as clinical social work associates, or CSWAs, or as licensed clinical social workers, LCSWs. The technical shorthand term for this is title protection. What this means is that only those who are licensed with the board under these two licenses are allowed to refer to themselves and advertise themselves to the public and other parties, such as employers or insurance companies, as LCSWs or CSWAs. These licensees are under full authority of the board for their conduct and must meet rigorous licensure and examination requirements, including 2 years of supervised clinical practice after completion of their master's in social work. Unlicensed individuals can practice as well, but are not allowed to hold themselves out as licensed by this board by use of one of the two currently protected titles. Obviously, in Oregon, we are out of step with the rest of the country and much of the remaining health professions here by not requiring a license for anyone who practices. The board's perspective is that Oregonians who utilize the services of a social work professional in times of crisis and distress need to be able to trust that the person providing assistance has the basic education and expertise to meet their needs and will support them in an ethical manner. The board currently licenses about 3,500 individuals at the master's level and estimates that up to 50% of the people who have master's in social work degrees, or MSWs, and who are providing professional services to Oregonians are not regulated by the state. Our agency is committed to protecting the public first, and our ultimate goal is full regulation of the profession. Senate Bill 177 before you today is not the fulfillment of the ultimate goal. Rather, it represents a very, very carefully crafted compromise the board worked out in close consultation with the governor's office and key stakeholders during the course of last year. After early attempts to craft and pass a Full Practice Act mandating licensure failed to get off the ground. In brief, the bill adds the following new provisions to the statutes of the board. Permits voluntary registration for bachelor-level social workers. Permits voluntary licensure for non-clinical master-level social workers. Expand sanction authority by the Board of Clinical Social Workers by allowing the board to maintain jurisdiction over revoked licensees and prohibiting them from practice. Increases civil penalty maximum to $5,000 per violation and changes the name of the board to Board of Licensed Social Workers. Chair Morissette and members of the committee, the board believes this bill before you would protect Oregonians from those whose licenses have been revoked by the board, and it would expand, on a voluntary basis, the board's authority to regulate the social work profession by adding two new protected titles to the board's authority. I would like to especially emphasize the issue of continued authority over licensees whose license has been revoked. It is nothing short of embarrassing and shameful that under current board authority, even the maximum consequence for having sex with a client, which is revocation of license, only means that the former licensee can no longer call themselves an LCSW, but keep right on practicing, including to continue with such harmful behavior with zero authority by the board to do something about it. I wish I could tell you this is just theoretical, but the bottom line is the board has revoked licensees for sexual transgressions, and we know for a fact that this has not stopped their ability to practice. One of our cases, the case of Leo Munter, revoked for sexual misconduct in 2000, received special attention in a May 23, 2007 Oregonian article after a client attempted to file a complaint and discovered Mr. Munter was unlicensed after his license has been revoked. In closing, the board supports this bill as a first step in the right direction of public protection and a compromise that has the support of the key stakeholders involved. The board respectfully requests the committee's support for this bill together with the technical amendments we request. In addition, I would like to thank the chair for hearing this bill so quickly and for the opportunity to appear before you this morning. Thank you for your time. And with consent of the chair, I'd like to turn over the testimony now to Martin Pidione, Executive Director for the board, for review of the technical amendments and any questions you may have about specific bill language.
Okay. First of all, are there any questions considering this? Okay, go ahead.
Chair Senator Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Pitioni, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Clinical Social Workers. I want to first add my thanks for hearing this important consumer protection bill so quickly. Before I briefly review the requested amendments with you, I want to share very briefly two items with the committee. One is that, coincidentally, just 24 hours before this hearing, I had yet another case of a phone call coming to me from someone who described to me a situation where she allegedly received therapy services that turned into a long-term intimate relationship with a therapist who turned out to be someone this board had revoked in 2000 for sexual misconduct with a client. You know, I've been in around this building for 20 years off and on, over 20 years off and on, and I know kind of the etiquette for testifying, but it's really hard not to get emotional about this stuff, and I really, really wish that I never have to have a conversation like I did yesterday again. It was really hard to tell this individual that this board had no authority to do anything about this conduct, no authority to initiate an investigation, and had no tools in its toolbox to stop this conduct. So it's my hope that with this bill and your help, this is one of the last times I need to have one of those conversations, and that this session we move forward and we do a better job for protecting our fellow citizens by finally giving this board explicit authority over revoked licensees to prevent them from practicing. Second, as alluded to in the prior testimony, we've been very busy and diligently working with our stakeholders to bring you a compromise bill. I do need to disclose that we worked, although we did that, including eliminating any impact on state agencies with respect to costs by taking a voluntary approach to licensure. It's something quite frankly, I want to take a little bit of a further look at. I noticed that the bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and so I want to take a close look at that and see where that's coming from, because it might be based on a misreading of the bill as mandatory, so we'll have to take a little bit of a further look at that. In any case, we were notified 2 days ago by a new concern out of the Department of Human Services, and we don't have any specific written information yet at this time. We expect that to happen imminently, and then the board will carefully assess what solutions are possible to address that remaining concern out of DHS. I suspect that it's related to what another party, I think SEIU, will be testifying shortly. Again, we'll figure this out as we go along. We're obviously committed to working with all of our stakeholders and go from there. Basically, the stance of the board will be that the basic policy thrust of the bill and the basic political compromise underlying the bill, you know, we don't want to undermine it, and we'll figure that out with any potential amendments, including those that may come from the Oregon chapter of National Association of Social Workers, where we're, you know, very grateful that they're here today and that they're here in support of this bill and in favor of greater regulation of the profession. Unfortunately, I do need to kind of move from the more exciting world of the underlying politics to the much more boring job of reviewing the technical amendments with you. I submitted those to your very kind administrator, Jennifer Keller, on Monday with our request that the Legislative Council draw this up on behalf of the committee. I'll just very briefly go over those. Bottom line is, this is one of those bills where, you know, it came out of Ledge Council literally on December 1, so there was absolutely no way to work again with Legislative Council to go over the language that came out of there. It's obviously a somewhat longer bill, and so there are a few technical problems that we need to address. One simply is a definitional problem that we want to fix, because the term regulated social worker is clearly defined under the bill and ties in directly to the four licensing options with the board. But the language, especially in Section 3 and 5, which are really key sections of this bill, also utilize the term regulated social work, and that's not really defined in the bill or in statute, and so we want to try to clean that up and fix that, especially because that's the kind of issue that feeds into confusion about the bill and whether the board's trying to do more than regulating the four titles if this bill were to pass under this bill. The second amendment is also really important to us because it relates directly to this issue we discussed earlier about, you know, retaining authority over revoked licensees. The bill seems to do that. However, it stops short of, and I think it was just an accidental issue, it stops short of actually giving us explicit civil penalty authority to actually sanction those individuals who continue practicing after revocation. The board's existing statutes only have civil penalty authority for those people that are licensees. So it's really, really imperative that we get something in this bill that gives us really clear authority that we can sanction individuals who practice after revocation. The other amendments really are, quite frankly, the really truly boring ones. They really only have to do with removing overly specific license and registration renewal requirements language from Section 14. That we would prefer not to have that specifically in statute, especially since we're also still working with stakeholders on how exactly these two new titles would exactly become operational and what the specific requirements of them would be. And we want to make a correction to Section 39 with respect to abuse reporting, because that was intended to apply to all licensees and not just to clinical social workers, and a correction in Section 40 to remove unnecessary duplicative language. In closing, I'd like to thank the chair, Senator Morissette, and the committee for your consideration in getting these technical amendments on their way, for hearing the bill, and for listening to us this morning. And Vice Chair Becky Rasmussen and I will be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions?
Mr. Chair? Yes. How many licensed clinical social workers are there?
We have about, if it's just the licensed clinical social workers, not our CSWAs, there's about 2,500, there's about 2,800 right now, I believe.
Okay, and then how many licensed social workers?
Overall licensee base of this board right now is 3,500.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Yes, Senator Berger.
Thank you for your testimony. I just would like to make some comments that people who go to services that you provide are very vulnerable. And I think it's a sad commentary that we are not protecting very vulnerable people who are reaching out for help. And because that help has some authority to it, they become quite dependent and are led down, from your testimony, some pretty pathetic paths. I guess that my question is, why are you not stronger in your bill? I would think that you would be wanting to protect people from people that simply are doing the wrong thing, and these are not minor things that they're doing. And so I guess my question is, why have you compromised?
Chair Senator Morris, Senator Berger, it's simply an issue of political realities. There are, as we said in our testimony, our preference it would be full regulation of the profession. However, the reality is we have to compromise with our stakeholders. There was significant concern, especially out of other state agencies, what the cost of actually mandating licensure would be. And so, you know, quite frankly, we had to work very diligently in the interim with the governor's office on bringing a bill before you that would satisfy those concerns. And, you know, as you're very likely aware, state agencies have to go through a very, very rigorous process that really starts almost 8 months or so before the actual start of the legislative session, going through a review process internally, you know, with the Department of Administrative Services and the governor's office, to bring this before you as an agency bill. And that means that a lot of these discussions behind the scenes have already happened by the time they get to you. And that's kind of a good news and kind of a bad news situation here, okay? The good news part, if you wish to look at it that way, is that we're trying to bring you something that has as little opposition as possible. The bad news is that you're obviously correct. You know, we would love to go further. This is as far as we think we can go without the bill running into trouble. And it's a tough position to be in.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd just like to make the comment that, you know, I feel that people that serve on panels like this serve as protectors of people that are very vulnerable. And certainly people who are looking for this kind of help become extremely dependent and vulnerable, and I think it's sad that we can't offer a little bit more protection for people that are trying to reach out to get themselves healthy and back on track, and they're very vulnerable to suggestions by authority. So those would be my comments on this particular bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many complaints annually do you get against unlicensed social workers?
Chair Senator Morissette, Senator Cruz, a quick clarification. Did you ask about unlicensed social workers?
Right.
I mean,
obviously you get complaints against people in your scope, but I'm assuming anybody who's got a complaint against a social worker may not know whether they're licensed or not, so the complaint would go to you, I'm assuming. So
that's Chair Senator Morissette, Vice Chair Senator Cruz. I'm a little bit at a loss how to exactly answer that question. I mean, basically, when we get a complaint in the door that somebody is clearly, I mean, it's very easy for us to figure out, is this person a licensee or not?
Right.
You know, we can tell this person then very quickly, hey, we don't have authority over this person because this person isn't licensed with us.
Right.
Because we don't have a practice act, we then don't get to open a complaint about unlicensed practice. That's the connection, I think, that you're looking for. And so, therefore, there isn't an official record of, you know, complaint numbers that I can give you, because we can't actually pursue those complaints. You know, I used to, in one of my former job lives, was with the Board of Psychologist Examiners. They have a practice act, mm-hmm. and as you just heard in earlier testimony, they are able to engage in actual physical complaints about the unlicensed practice of psychology. That's a luxury that we don't have. That's one that we would have if we had a practice act, but we don't. And so that's the reason I have some difficulty in specifically answering your question.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, follow up. I knew you would, which is why I brought it up. So.
And if I may, Chair Morissette,
yes.
and members of the committee, yeah, those are really counting, not really grasping or getting those that are out there that would like to file a complaint but realize that there's no license, that they can't go, that mm-hmm. they can't go after. So I know there's some practitioners in the area here that I would love to go before a board, but there's no board. Because they have no license.
Mr. Chair, part of the reason I did that, I'm kind of a proponent for a practice act versus a title act, but mm-hmm. that's just me. So
now, what aside from financial concerns, what's the problem with getting a practice act? What are the complications you would be going through?
Chair, Senator Morissette, and members of the committee, one of my troubles with questions like this is that I'm very new to the board and I'm not as familiar with all of the history mm-hmm. on the long discussions that have gone on with the stakeholders. My understanding is that part of the issue is that those who prefer that we have a full practice act would prefer that there wouldn't be any exemptions. That issue is, quite frankly, a very controversial issue because there is significant resistance by other stakeholders, and we have had to make commitments in order to bring this to you as an agency bill
okay.
that, you know, basically that we can't go there.
Okay. I sense that, yes.
Mr. Senator Chair, I think hopefully DHS will come up to testify. There are a number of social workers in DHS, and probably a lot of them are not licensed. Mm-hmm. And that is okay. where the rubber hits
yes,
the road.
Yeah, that's it.
And
yeah.
so
that we're gonna hear
I think
that,
yeah. we really need to have them talk to us from their perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But there, in that situation, they have supervisors in our... having been a public employee as a nurse, there is supervision, and we're so concerned, I think, about the independent practice at this point, although we should be concerned about those in DHS, but mm-hmm. they have oversight much better than those who are working independently. So I think that's probably where the problem lies.
Okay, thank you. Megan, would you come up, please, and contribute to this conversation?
Okay. Are we?
Yeah. Yeah, so just step down, and we may call you back, but for now, just step down.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm here representing the Service Employee International Union, which is the representative union for the employees at the Department of Human Services, as well as multiple nonprofits that serve our community. And I wish to testify about my concerns about Senate Bill 177 by starting with a clarification that I am not here testifying on behalf of the Department of Human Services, that I am here testifying on behalf of the members of SEIU and how this bill would impact them professionally. So I want to make that clarification that this is not testimony or the view of the Department of Human Services. This is the view of the represented members. I'd like to start with my concern, and I think that you brought up kind of, is this a titling board? Is this a practicing board? And I think the issues lie in that this is a hybrid of both. And that we need to have a conversation about that. First is looking at the scope of practice, that what is social work? And that there is some debate there, and that my concern is if we go to a practicing act, and there are some pieces, particularly Section 5, which go toward that direction, that we really need to look at scope of practice. And just start with the definition of practice of baccalaureate of social work. Is the basic general practice of social work that includes assessment, planning, intervention, evaluation, case management, information referral, counseling, supervision, consultation, education, advocacy, community organization, and the development, implementation, and administration of policies, programs, and activities. I think that is an extremely broad definition. Others have to do with the organization of groups and individuals. I think as a titling act, it's appropriate to have a broad scope. But when we talk about a practicing act, it's like saying nurses do health care. So if you do other forms of health care, you must be a nurse. And that's concerning because there are many professionals that engage in health care. That is not the definition of nurse. So my concern, not for going into Section 5, is that if somebody, particularly with the Department of Human Services, but also in our nonprofits, has chosen to become licensed under this board, even though their job does not require it, it is not a one where they need to be licensed. There are jobs within the Department of Human Services where you need to be a licensed clinical social worker, but others do not. We do not call people who do case management social workers. They're called case managers. If you take a job that does not require that you be licensed, but you choose to because you have obtained that education in which to participate and use that license, I think it's entirely appropriate for the board to have discretion over your licensure and revoke it. But it is not appropriate for them to have the authority to bar you from practicing any of that scope of practice. That you could never be involved in advocacy or education. You could never do case management. You could never do the broad list of things. That's extremely concerning to us. Because if you're going to go toward allowing them to regulate not licensed or people who have been their license revoked, and I think we need to have a much different scope of practice than an incredibly broad one. I have no problem with the board having the right to revoke somebody's license at all. I have no problem with them regulating the use of the term social worker. I think that that is important, and I'd like to say that we don't use the term social worker for someone who is not a social worker. I do have concerns about how Section 3, which talks about identifying yourself, would impact those who have MSWs. That's an education as well. So if someone has gotten a master's in social work and has not chosen to go through the licensing process, I still think it's appropriate for them to be able to call themselves a master of social work. That's a degree, much like I have an MA in American politics. I don't necessarily have to be engaged in American politics to use that term. So we have concerns there of how it would affect our workers who are MSWs, who are not licensed, and do not need to be licensed for their job, but also very real concerns about our members being put in a position where it is a disincentive to be licensed. We encourage and have worked with the department toward expanding educational opportunities so that workers at the Department of Human Services can go and get MSWs and would have the option of getting licensed. But if we had a situation where if you were an employee and there is an issue, the department could deal with it internally. You are not licensed. The department would deal with it internally. You may be disciplined, but you would not be fired or removed from your job. That same worker who would be licensed would have an external body say, we take away your license, which is their right, but then because of Section 5, could no longer work and do their job at the Department of Human Services. That creates a disincentive for DHS workers to want to get licensed.
Yeah, Senator Ms. Anderson.
I worked for Multnomah County as a public health nurse for just a few years. We were actually, though, represented by Oregon Nurses Association. And I sort of correlate this with that statement because the Board of Nursing could definitely take away my license, and I could not then work for the county. So in that sense, because we're working with people, we needed to have the Board of Nursing overseeing nurses, and in a sense, maybe the setup that the social workers want is the same sort of thing. They have their board, and yes, there are employees at DHS, but again, we have a practice act, yeah. And at this point in time, we do not have that. So it's an area that we need to start thinking about. Let's put it that way.
And my response, I absolutely see that. And for the jobs that require an LCSW, which there are within the Department of Human Services, and we represent, some examples are the state hospital have positions that require an LCSW. If that worker were to have their license revoked, they would no longer be able to be employed. I also would like, I know there are very real concerns about people abusing their position with clients, of which we've never defended workers. If like the example that was brought before, someone were to have an inappropriate or any sexual relationship with a client, they would be terminated by the Department of Human Services and would not be eligible to be hired. And on behalf of the union, I would find it very unlikely that we would arbitrate that. But there is a process. I do think the Department of Human Services is very sensitive to those type of issues and internally deals with them, and people are terminated and would no longer be eligible to work for the Department of Human Services.
Okay. Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we're veering off the topic of SB 177 a little bit. I just want to encourage the board to pursue scope of practice, basically, in the Practice Act. And here's why. You know, a couple weeks ago, President Courtney commented to you all that I didn't want to be called an accountant. There's a difference between a CPA and an accountant, and it's scope. And if you're going to have those initials after your name, whether they be in this context as a social worker or as a CPA, there's some specific things that you do that an accountant is not permitted to do, and so the society doesn't necessarily know those differences. And so anyway, I can feel your pain, so to speak, and in order to deal with that is obviously a scope of practice. There are a lot of CPAs that are working in industry for a company, one company, basically one client. And if they use the term CPA after a name, they have to adhere to certain things. If they don't, then they don't have to adhere to it. But in general, many of the functionality is the same. So outside of SB 177, I know what this topic is, but I would like to see the board pursue that, and with that come a scope of practice address that issue.
Thank you.
Did you want to respond? Senator Cruz, did you have some?
Well, just a slight confusion, something that was a bit troubling. Because if we have a licensed social worker that is sanctioned by the board and the result is revocation of license, it's probably an appropriate action. But we are saying inside the Department of Human Services, if they aren't licensed, they could potentially do the same egregious act and potentially not get fired and keep working. And so I'm wondering, I guess part of my issue here is if we look across the scope of DHS, which is massive, and we get into some other areas, child welfare, different things like that, but I think part of the problem with the department, maybe there's not enough external oversight, period. And so I'm thinking, you know, having an external body that has oversight over the workers inside the agency makes some sense to me. Comment.
Yes. I, just for the record, Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, I think maybe I should clarify that, much like the example that Senator Telfer gave, that there are people who are licensed who are not doing jobs that require them to be a social worker. And we can have some conversations about the department and what their educational requirements are for jobs and what they do or do not classify as social work, and I think that is a debate. But for many positions within the Department of Human Services, it is not required that you have an MSW, an LCSW, that you even have a baccalaureate in social work. There are many other education backgrounds that would qualify you to do those same jobs. So within, and they do not call themselves social workers. So if someone happens to have gotten their MSW and gone through the licensure process and has a license, that is, it may make them more qualified and more attractive candidate, but it is not a requirement for them to have that job with the Department of Human Services, and others who do not have their same background are also qualified. And with, you know, if is that social work, isn't that social work, that's a scope of practice conversation. They are not called social workers by the Department of Human Services, and, you know, one could debate, you know, what exactly is social work? What would they be regulating?
Yeah. Followed by, I guess, Ms. Chair, an example outside of this scope would be there are employees for the Department of Environmental Quality that are doing jobs that their education and training would not allow them to be licensed to do if they're in the private sector. And so there is some disconnects between inside government and outside government. And so, you know, this is a big scope here. I understand that. So.
Yes, Senator Mike.
Yes. Now it appears that this bill, though, is a compromise, and I would really like the proponents of this bill to address your concerns about MSW, address the concerns in Section 3 and in Section 5, because I really want to pursue this bill, and so we need. Because I really feel it's in the best interest of Oregonians to clean up at least those that are in the private sector, and I know that this is a huge issue in the public sector, but why would we want to prevent good care to those that are in the prevent good care in the private sector. So this is an issue I think that we need to pursue, but we want to make sure that the bill doesn't get so expensive that we can't, that it would never get out of Ways and Means. Yeah.
And I, Senator Morissette, Senator Mona Sanderson, it is always the intention of SCA Unit's membership to provide the highest quality care and integrity in the work we do and in our shared profession publicly. So we are more than happy to engage in a conversation because we, too, do not want to, for those who are social workers, do not want to cheapen the profession.
Now, Megan, it seems to me, or have you been engaged in the conversation with the proponents of the bill?
I was not engaged in drafting this legislation. I have had a conversation with a previous board member about a year and a half ago about this, at which point I raised some concern, have not seen anything since, but was consulted a year and a half ago and raised concerns at that point.
Okay. One of the reasons for hearing this bill early is because it's going to take a while. So,
Ms. Chair.
And the department is here, and they're listening carefully.
Ms. Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
If you have any written testimony, it would be very helpful for us.
I will submit some.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Megan. We have Stacy Scola and Jessica Ritter.
Good morning, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. My name is Stacy Scala Orr. I am the Executive Director of the National Association of Social Workers, Oregon Chapter. I am here today to lend our support and testify in favor of SB 177, which expands the regulation and title protection for professional social workers and ensures greater protection for consumers. I would like to state for the record, in light of the previous testimony, that we do see SB 177 primarily as a title protection and consumer protection bill. We do share the long-term version of a Scope of Practice Act. At this time, our reservations for that is that we need to ensure an adequate workforce supply and do some analysis and work with stakeholders, as well as make sure educational mechanisms are in place towards scope of practice and ensuring the degree requirements for social work licensure. But regarding SB 177, again, I'm here today to lend our support and also to propose a modification to SB 177, which we believe strengthens this legislation and results in greater consumer protection and ensures our full support of the legislation. Mm-hmm. As has been discussed, I think as a society, we've come to trust that persons that use certain titles have completed specific training to prepare them for their work in assisting the public. For example, residents of Oregon certainly do not want to receive legal advice from someone identifying as a lawyer who does not have the required degree and training, state regulation, who's held accountable to professional ethics and standards. Nor would a resident want to receive care from someone identifying themselves as a nurse who also does not have the appropriate degree and training and is not regulated by the state. Accredited social work programs face stringent requirements as they prepare caring professionals to obtain their bachelor's, master's, and doctorate degrees in social work. Currently, in the state of Oregon, the only title protection reserved for professional social workers is the Clinical Social Work Associate, or CSWA, and the Licensed Clinical Social Worker, LCSW, designation. What this means is that anyone, regardless of their degree and training or lack thereof, can identify themselves to the public as a social worker. NASW Oregon chapter is very supportive of the core concept in SB 177. It further regulates the profession by adding a bachelor's and non-clinical master's level designation, the registered bachelor's social worker RBSW and the licensed master's social worker designation, the LMSW. It defines a regulated social worker as an individual who is registered, certified, or licensed by the state of Oregon. In addition, it prevents individuals whose designation has been revoked by the state board from continuing to identify themselves as a regulated social worker or engage in the practice of social work as defined in legislation. However, in order to strengthen SB 177 and expand its protection to consumers, we are proposing a key modification. As written, particularly in Section 3, this legislation only prevents a person from using any title, words, or abbreviations to indicate that they have an authorization to practice regulated social work, unless they are, in fact, a regulated social worker as defined. So as it's written, our concern is, given the way that a regulated social worker is defined and the authorization to practice regulated social work, in essence, this only protects the four designations, the two new proposed designations, RBSW, LMSW, as well as the existing CSWA and LCSW designation. As such, it does not protect the title social worker, therefore allowing anyone to continue identifying as such, which we believe continues to put consumers and the profession at risk.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And I think that the Board of Clinical Social Workers brought up this concern about Section 3, as well as Megan from SEIU brought this up, so it would behoove everyone if all three of you could get together regarding amendments to that section. If you can come up with a compromise, that would be great.
Absolutely. Be prepared to participate in that process. It is our recommendation and the position of NASW Oregon Chapter that we would modify this legislation so that the language would specify that persons could not use the title social worker in any form or variation unless they are a regulated social worker, which means anyone identifying and presenting themselves to the public as a social worker is registered, certified, or licensed by the state of Oregon, with the exception of reference to one's academic credentials containing the words social work, which was a concern raised in previous testimony, and we are in agreement with that would be an exception We urge your support of this legislation, as well as the modifications that have been discussed, to ensure that anyone presenting themselves to the public as a social worker has the appropriate degree, training, is regulated by the state, is held accountable to the professional ethics and standards that are characteristic of our profession. I thank you for your time, the opportunity to testify, and for your consideration. And with the consent of the chair, I'd like to turn the testimony to our legislative chair.
Wait, just a minute. Would you even go so far as to recommend that an individual carry identification with on their person when they need to act professionally? Because social worker, it's like community organizer, right? I mean, there are so many variations. It's a very common term, and if you want people to be verified, if you want them to verify, you go to, you know, a member of the public is not going to understand what we're doing right here, but if they are really concerned and if they know that there are some strict rules concerning who these people are, maybe they should carry a card.
Chair Morissette, it's certainly our position that I think that's part of the problem. That's the term social worker is used freely.
It's used frequently.
And it can be used for almost anything. Freely. It's used by individuals who, in fact, do not possess.
So if you feel strongly about that, I suggest that we think about a card that they can show in case they need to be identified as being what they are.
I just want you to know we just passed a bill that eliminated the card from nurses just because it's so abused.
Yes, and I believe Chair Morissette and Senator Mons Anderson, I appreciate the comment, and we believe that regulation by the state and ability, the degree and examination requirements associated with certification, registration, or licensure, we believe then satisfies that then when someone does identify as being a social worker, that the public associates that with the fact that they are indeed not only have the appropriate
degree. The public will not know the difference.
No. But Mr. Chair, thank you. Do you have a website that lists at all the licensed clinical social workers in the state?
Chair Morissette,
I'm sort of looking to the board.
That's public information through the State Board of Clinical Social Workers, where somebody could, review the list of licensees. The difficulty beyond that is there are degreed social workers practicing in the state that aren't regulated by the state currently, as well as other professionals who may be identifying as such.
But just follow up. I think the point I'm trying to make is we had this conversation with the Board of Nursing, and they are finding that they now they have a website, and they can see anyone who has encumbrances, I think, on them. But that they can also call the board and find out who is really a licensed RN. And so I'm just wondering if when we get to that point, if maybe the Board of Clinical Social Workers will need to go to that route also. So that
and, Chair Morissette and Senator Mons Anderson, although that certainly would be up to the Board of Clinical Social Workers, but currently the mechanism is in place to identify who is under their their authority as a licensed clinical social worker. So I would share that recommendation that then with the expansion and addition of other regulatory categories, the RBSW, LMSW, that those individuals could be identified as well.
Well, I hope so. Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Jessica Ritter. I serve as the chair of the Legislative Committee for the National Association of Social Workers, Oregon Chapter. I'm also a professor in the state of Oregon. And since we've been talking a lot about credentials today, I have a bachelor's in social work, a master's in social work, and a doctorate in social
work.
Can you
prove that?
I can. I have the degrees hanging on my wall. First, I would like to say that, again, NESW, we are supporting this bill, Senate Bill 177, and I really want to thank the State Board of Clinical Social Workers for all of the hard work that they have put into studying this issue and drafting this legislation. We really appreciate that because we know it's an important issue of making sure that consumers in Oregon are protected. from social services and providers of social services. So I just want to very briefly offer a few recommendations and possible things to think about as we go forward. The first thing is, as a social work educator of undergraduate social work students, I want to ask the board to be very cautious and reasonable when they think about assessing the fees that are associated with becoming regulated and also the examination fees. As we all know, social workers' starting salaries are very low, and we found from our own study here in Oregon that often many social workers actually have more student loan debt than they, you know, it's higher than their actual starting salary. So we just want to ask that they think about having the fees be as reasonable as possible, especially if this is going to be voluntary. We don't want it to be a deterrent to social workers becoming regulated by the state. A very minor suggestion is that we have the LCSW, and they're recommending to add the LMSW, and a possible, we're just a little worried about the confusion of people because it sounds very similar. So one thing to think about is having the master social worker registered and calling it an RMSW, just so people don't get confused by those two designations. And finally, there's one issue that came to our attention a couple days ago, and we're looking into it, and we didn't really have the time needed to look into it further, but I want to raise this. An attorney that consults with us has expressed concerns with Sections 12 and 19 of the bill. Section 12 basically raises the civil penalty from $1,000 to $5,000, and he was concerned that in some cases social workers who are not guilty of what they've been accused of may go ahead and just sign the disciplinary action because they fear the risk of not being able to pay such a high penalty. And I think also attorney's fees would be additional to that. And he was also concerned that in Section 19 that it addresses the complainant and what protections they have, and he was concerned that there were too many protections for the complainant and that it may be a little too easy for people to harass a social worker or to file a complaint for not very serious reasons. So just wanted to make sure that there would be some sort of consequence to that if someone was making a complaint against a social worker for those reasons. I do want to just really briefly say that due to the previous testimony, we would be extremely uncomfortable with any kind of exemption from DHS, and we think that holding state social workers who work for the state to a lesser standard than other social workers would not be a good thing. So we wanted to be very clear about that. And then finally, I just wonder if it would be useful to pull together some sort of a work group. You know, since it does seem like there have been a series of amendments offered, we would be happy to participate in some sort of work group. So thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you, and I think that's an excellent idea. Comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, others wishing to testify? I'm seeing. Oh!
Oh, my God. Well, we're in trouble now.
Well, I made the offer, and she kind of thought about it for a while.
Well, I got the nod from Martin, so I think I'm okay. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm the Director of Public Policy and Government Relations for the Department of Human Services. I have no initials after my name except a GED, and I'm still waiting for my GED class reunion, but they don't evidently have them.
Okay. You want a card?
I have one. It's really old. It says I actually passed my GED. I don't mean to make light of this. I really don't have any prepared testimony. I wasn't expecting to testify because Martin Pitone and I have talked a couple times, and yesterday we talked, and he agreed to mention that he was going to maybe work out some amendments. However, I do feel compelled, since Martin gave me the nod to come up, mention a couple of things. I don't want to debate. There's a lot behind this bill.
Right.
This isn't new, and my concerns are not new. The bill in its former form prior to Martin was a practices act, a full-blown practices act. And we priced it because, as you know, we have about 10,000 employees. their definition of social work includes, it, at its broadest term, probably every single person in our department does referrals. I develop policies. We all do that kind of work. When you narrow that scope down and look at really who works one-on-one with clients in some form, you're talking about 3,600 people in our department, not counting counties, AAAs, O4ADs, nonprofits, and other people that we contract with. And as Megan mentioned, we do have positions out in the Oregon State Hospital that we require to be licensed clinical social workers. They're doing clinical social work with people that, with patients and clients and consumers in the state hospital. They're doing that kind of work. And if they did something to get their license revoked, they would be fired. However, we do have a lot of employees that are MSWs and BSWs, and they're not working in that capacity, i.e., we don't require them to have it. It's nice, and it might get them ahead in an interview, but it's not a requirement of their position. We have a couple of problems with the bill that Martin has agreed to sit down and chat with us about. I'm hoping that those will be taken care of. But we've had other people up here saying we don't want DHS to be exempt, blah, blah, blah. I understand in the private sector that there are people that hang their shingles without being licensed, and that concerns me as a mother, as a grandmother, and as a person. When I walk into a private office, I want some oversight of these people when they're digging into the deepest, darkest depths of family problems. And so I'm very supportive, and the department is supportive, of a private sector practices act and them expanding their regulations to include those people. Washington and California both have full-blown practices acts, but they also exempt public employees because, A, of the cost, B, we have much, much oversight already, and having another layer of oversight and revoking a license and us having to deal with union contracts and where people can work and what they can do, it just sort of, you know, grays up the water. And I only looked at those two states because they were our neighbors, and they both exempt public employees, and there must be a reason for that. I know the national folks have come up and said they don't want us exempt, but there's a reason why our neighboring states do exempt public employees. If, in fact, we don't call any of our workers social workers. That's not their title. They may have an MSW, but we don't call them social workers. If, in fact, there's a reason to believe some of them practice social work, I think it's something that the board, either the local board or the national board, should actually talk to DAS about. There are other state agencies involved in this, OIA, Corrections, Commission on Children and Families, that have the same kind of employees doing some of the same kind of work our folks do. So maybe they should go to DAS and look at our entire personnel system and identify some positions, because we can't just, you know, have them telling one state agency who they should license and who they shouldn't license. I think it should really be something that's applied statewide and talked to about our you know, executive branch personnel folks, and not just us, because it's affecting other state agencies, not just ours.
Okay. Now, you have had conversations with Martin throughout this, or have
I have
you
had
not?
Two conversations.
Okay, Martin,
with Martin,
would you come up, please? And because I know we're going to go to some kind of a conference, mediation,
right, and we don't
want to,
you know, we're both state agencies. That's why we're going to go away and work together. But I just heard other people say things. I wanted to explain
sure.
a little more about the department. And let me just finish by saying you're right, Senator Mones Anderson. We have a lot of nurses that work for DHS. We have nurses that work for DHS that are doing accounting work. We have nurses working for DHS that are public health nurses, and they're required to be nurses. And if they're licensed, were pulled, they would no longer have a job. If for some reason a licensed nurse allowed their license to lapse and they worked in our accounting section, we're not going to tell them they can't work anymore, or if they were working on policy or something, because it's not required. We have doctors that we require to be licensed physicians. Dr. Bruce Goldberg is a licensed physician, but it's not required by his position. He did once bring his otoscope to work and wanted to look in my ear, and I wouldn't let him because I had an earache. And I told him that he was not my physician, and he could not look in anything in my body. So,
oh, in your mind.
With that, I'll answer any questions.
That was a hell of a straight line. I'll let
Martin, identify yourself again, please.
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, Martin Pitioni, Executive Director for the Board of Clinical Social Workers. I really don't want to take up the time of the committee with the pieces that really need to go into the work group. Mm-hmm. I do want to do two quick things, just because there seemed to be a little bit of confusion. Just put those on the record, because those are kind of the easy things we can get out of the way. One is the issue on the education issue that was raised, that somehow there might be something in this bill that would impact on people that are masters of social work. There is no title protection in this bill for masters of social work. So, you know, somebody using that educational title, it's not a problem. The Office of Degree Authorization in the state of Oregon is the one that regulates educational titles and the recognition thereof. The board does not. The board has no authority to take away someone's educational title. You know, there's nothing in the board statutes that has that authority. That's not us. So that's really not an issue here, and that's, I think, a very easy one that we can deal with. The only other piece that I want to just very clearly put on the record, because there seemed to be some confusion, especially earlier in the testimony coming from SEIU, there are four protect. If this bill were to pass, there would be four protected titles under the statutes of the board, two new ones and two existing ones. The only piece in this legislation that's really where a practice act approach is taken, and where you really get into the definitions of, you know, what's bachelor level social work, what's non-clinical master's level social work, what's clinical social work at the master's level, and really get into those definitions, which are new in the bill. The only place where they play a role is in connection with revocation of licensees, not in connection with, you know, what's happening at DHS or any other places now. That's the only place where that kicks in. The scope of practice right now under this bill is simply to allow us to make sure that if we have someone who comes in and whose license were revoked, that we actually have something that defines what the various forms of practice are, so we can prohibit them from doing that. That's the only place where there's really a practice act approach under this bill. The rest really is title protection under the four titles. I hope that helps clarify that a little bit.
Okay. Thank you. I guess you are going to have further discussions.
I'm sure we are.
I guess I'd like to personally follow up on this and make sure that the right people are at the table, and just be apprised of where you are before we call you back.
Chair Senator Morissette, be happy to do that.
Okay. And Patty, I will be discussing this with you as well.
Right. Senator, I look forward to it.
Okay. Well, but this is a very important act, and it is very complicated because, you know, the scope, well, the number of people in DHS or in as you mentioned, working for the state in general, and DAS is very large, and it is fairly complicated. So
right, and we will be at the table whenever Martin calls the group together.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Verger.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make a comment. I just think that the protection of vulnerable people is so important. I think when you're looking at who's working with people that are just almost at the mercy emotionally of other people, which implies some of this, not all of this, but some of this, that this is a very serious discussion from my point of view.
I agree, and if you wish to participate in any of the discussions, we will notify you. In fact, I'm going to be working with Martin and Patty and kind of keep on top of this, and I'll let the committee know where we are on this. So with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 177 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 162. we have someone to testify on 163. Oh. Okay, Mary Gare, would you introduce yourself, please? And
certainly.
Bring us up to date.
Good morning, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Gare. I'm the administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care in the Seniors and People with Disabilities Division, Oregon Department of Human Services. And given the conversation so far today, I'm an MSW, and I think by the qualification would be a non-clinical social worker. I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 162. This is a bill that affects several parts of the Department of Human Services. This affects adult foster homes that serve people with developmental disabilities, people with physical disabilities, seniors, and people who are receiving addictions and mental health services. This is a bill that the department has requested and fully supports. I do want to be clear that this is a bill that affects only adult foster homes. This does not affect children's homes. The current practice when we do a complaint investigation in an adult foster home is that we release a report, and that report is public information. Federal guidelines around HIPAA, the Health Information Portability and Accountability Act, require that we keep protected health information confidential. And it's long been the practice that we do not identify victims or perpetrators, for that matter, in our Adult Protective Services reports. There's no names, there's no connection of a name with protected health information. However, the problem we've come across is that in our foster home, in particular our foster home settings, which are five people or less, often less, the information that we would put in a public record required by state law for public information on a complaint investigation may very well identify an individual in such an intimate setting. So, for example, a foster home complaint investigation report might say something like, the resident is a 52-year-old woman with cerebral palsy who has a history of schizophrenia and who uses a wheelchair. In an intimate setting of three or four or five people, simply those descriptors, which are not protected by HIPAA, might make it very easy to identify who we're talking about in that particular home. So what we're asking for in this legislation is the ability to redact information in complaint investigation reports for foster homes that takes out even further, even more information beyond HIPAA that might make it possible to identify who we're talking about in a particular foster home. As I said, this is a bill that is supported by the department, and we're asking for your help in giving us the authority to meet two needs, really to protect the privacy and dignity of people who are in foster homes who have been victimized, and also to protect the right that the public has to information about what's happening in long-term settings so that they can make decisions about where they might choose to receive services and supports. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Question. Has there been a... What prompts this bill?
Senator Morissette, Chair Morissette, we receive a lot of public records requests. Sometimes they're from individuals who are wanting to look at the complaint history of a particular home. We also receive and have seen an increase in the requests for public records information from the media who are wanting, for example, all of the complaint investigations against all people with developmental disabilities in the state of Oregon. And so we have increasing concern because of the increase. We certainly don't want to stop meeting the public records request, but we do want to make sure that people are protected in their privacy and confidentiality.
Grover, do you have any comments on this? Would you come up, please?
Mr. Chair, while he's coming up, I'm just citing, like my father was in assisted living, I would definitely, if there was any abuse of any kind or victimization, I would want to report it, but I would really want, since there's only 12 people in that unit, it would be very easy with certain information to identify that it really was my father, and that's not the point. Is that what you're getting at, by removing the demographics that would actually be able to identify the individual in a setting? Yeah.
Chair Morissette and Senator Moniz Anderson, the issue that you identify is exactly what we're getting at, to remove that information so that the person is not identifiable. I do want to point out that this bill addresses only foster homes, the settings of five or less. The larger settings, we have not found that to be as much of an issue. Thank you.
That's good. Grover, would you identify yourself, please?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Grover Simmons. I represent the Independent Adult Foster Home Association, and we're happy to support this bill. Historically, I usually appear before the committee on behalf of provider rights, but this is a residence rights issue, and we're delighted to support the department in asking that you pass this out. I would be interested in whether the committee would amend the bill to deal with substantiated complaints and unsubstantiated complaints in the adult foster home industry. That's an old chestnut that's been around for a long time, and I would welcome discussing that in detail at a future time if you'd like. We believe that unsubstantiated complaints should not be made public, and they should not go on the internet for all the problems that that creates, and only substantiated complaints should be published, and that's the essence of the desired amendment.
Mary?
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, I agree with my esteemed colleague that this is an old chestnut and is an issue that we have gone back and forth on quite a bit. The release of public information of both substantiated and unsubstantiated complaints is something that the department feels is important for public information, and we would not support such an amendment. The other... I'm happy to talk more about why that might be. I would also be concerned about adding that to this particular bill. We believe this is a very important issue for resident protection. I would not want that to get bogged down, if you will, with something that we may or may not agree on.
Okay. Why don't you agree that this... Do you substantiate claims?
Senator Morissette, Chair Morissette, we have actually three findings that are possible in an adult protective services complaint. One is that it's substantiated. That means that we went in and we found evidence that it actually did happen and it was abuse.
Okay.
The other is unsubstantiated. That means we went in and investigated and we did not find evidence to support the allegation of abuse. The third is that we were unable to determine. We try not to use that very often, but every once in a while there is a situation where we just can't tell. So we try to do substantiated or not. Mr. Simmons mentioned, we do have a website that we post all complaints on for all licensed facilities, and we post both substantiated and unsubstantiated.
Do you list them as substantiated or unsubstantiated?
Chair Morissette, absolutely.
Okay.
We do.
You do list them as unsubstantiated.
Chair Morissette, what we've heard from consumers is that they find the unsubstantiated and substantiated helpful. Sometimes it is useful for them to ask a provider, you've had a lot of unsubstantiated complaints, can you talk with me about that? And there are lots of circumstances that might contribute to that. For example, sometimes there's a disgruntled employee who makes a lot of allegations against a facility. So it really offers the opportunity for the consumer to have good information and be able to engage the provider in a discussion about what happened and why.
Identify yourself. Grover Simmons, Independent Adult Foster Home Association. First of all, we don't want to foul up this bill for the department, that's okay. If there's some interest in amending in a different bill, why we'd like to go that line. Mr. Gehr mentioned that the public uses this complaint file. Sure they do. And so if you're considering putting your parent, for example, in an adult foster home, you go to the local office and you look at the list, and here's a home with a number of unsubstantiated complaints. You're just not going to investigate that. You make a decision. I'm going to go to some home that doesn't have any complaints at all. So there's an economic decision made. It affects the industry. It's significant. But every couple of years, this subject takes on a new wrinkle. And within the last couple of years, there is another organization which is trying to build itself up, and they are marketing and advertising the fact of we can solve complaints, we can work with you on your complaints. And so they publish on the internet complaints, all kinds. And they misrepresented some information, and they were chastised, if you will, by the department. So that was good. But nevertheless, the misuse of unsubstantiated complaints continues to be an issue. And it comes up every once in a while, including this most recent marketing effort by an organization to build an association or a business using the information that's on the department's line. And I just think that's not good policy.
So we're talking about two different problems in a sense.
Yes.
And I think
we don't want to foul up.
That's good. But I understand your concern, and maybe with the department we need to think about how to deal with that. And I'm familiar, I think, with the company that you're talking about. It is a marketing gimmick, and it does sometimes give the wrong impression. And it is an economic detriment. It could be an economic detriment. So I think that's... Okay, further discussion. We're still in the public hearing part, but we will be going into a work session in a moment.
No,
we don't. We didn't have a possible work session for this.
No, we did not.
Okay. So we'll then come back to this. Any other discussion about this issue?
I'd just say I understand Grover's position here, but it gets really complicated because once it's posted, it's public domain, and so it's available. I'm not. There are a whole lot of issues with the internet. my pet peeve on that is, and members, if you will look at what IIT takes out of our email list, the spam, if you look at that, virtually all of them are offers of drugs or something of that nature, and totally unregulated. So the internet in and of itself has created some massive problems that I'm not quite sure how we get our hands around. But
Morissette, if I may, just for your information, the organization that we're speaking of gets information from the department about complaints through a public records request.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question, getting back to Senate Bill 162, as it's been presented. What's the cost? There's another memo here regarding if this does not go through, it would be costly for going through the records for each individual case. Work with each public records request on a case-by-case basis would be expensive. How many cases are we talking about?
Well, Chair Morissette and Senator Telfer, the just as an example, we had a public records request for all complaints that were against people in adult foster homes for serving people with developmental disabilities, and that was thousands of records.
Thousands.
Particular Chair Morissette and Senator Telfer, when we get a request that says we'd like a look back of 5 years, of 7 years, of 10 years, to look at trends and those kinds
of things. Do you charge for that?
Chair Morissette, yes, we do.
We have to bill.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, it took considerable.
Well, okay. What kind of charges are they? Are they minimal, adequate, prohibitive?
Chair Morissette, I don't know the charges off the top of my head. There is a Department of Human Services policy about public records requests and what we charge. I'd be happy to share that
with you. Well, I think this is an interesting topic because of, you know, in our current economic shortfall, we may... Sometimes a records request can be prohibitive to discourage people from asking for it, and it's outrageously expensive at times. At other times, it might be, you know, costing us money to do. So I'm adequate. Maybe we need to make some adjustments to be sure that they are adequate.
As I say, Chair Morissette, I'll be happy to share that policy and any analysis that we might have done around that with the committee.
Mr. Chair, I believe it was our desire that they cover their costs.
Yeah.
So... and then it's up to them to how they do.
Well, for cost of time spent and materials, yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, good. Just give us an update.
Absolutely, Chair Morissette.
Okay. Seeing no other business before. Well, I'll close the public hearing and we will adjourn.
Good meeting.
Right on time.
Right on time.